Chapter 7. Selling Tickets and Tankers. Gold might or might not be deserving of the opprobrious epithets heaped on it by moralising poets, and money might or might not be the root of all evil. But abstention from handling gold and silver was certainly one of the precepts taken by the Shramanera, or novice monk, at the time of his ordination. I had been ordained as a Shramanera at Kusinara in May 1949, and on my arrival in Kalimpong nearly a year later, was still observing the precept strictly, not touching money in any form, even though I knew that the majority of Shramaneras and bhikshus honoured the precept more in the breach than the observance. For my first 6 months in the town, I continued to observe the precept, relying on my alms ball for food and on the generosity of friends and lay supporters for whatever else I needed. At the end of this period, I found myself in a quandary. I had either personally to accept some money that had been collected for my support during the rainy season, when it would be difficult for me to go out on my morning alms round, or risk exposing the well-meaning person who had collected it to the charge of retaining it for his own benefit. In the end, I decided, most reluctantly, to accept it, and allowed the grubby currency notes and tarnished coins to be counted into my hand. Subsequently, I found myself having to raise funds for the Young Men's Buddhist Association, brackets India, as I had still to do for the Kalimpong branch of the Mahabodhi Society, and in this way came to be more involved with money than I had been for many years. According to a celebrated Mahayana treatise, the possession of gold and silver allowed a monk to be more useful to others and to help them. Very likely it did, but I was inclined to regard the argument as a rationalisation, and to wish that I, for one, could have helped people through my Buddhist work without the necessity of handling gold or silver, or rather, not having anything to do with money. One of the circumstances that had made my Assam tour so idyllic was the fact that our tickets for the journey once purchased, I could simply forget about money. Whether I was with the Bengali Buddhists or the Thai Buddhists, food, clothing, shelter and medicine, the four basic necessities for which the monk was dependent on the lay community, were all provided, and for the time being at least, I needed nothing more. It was like being on the open road, as I had been during my years as a wandering ascetic, when, equipped with my bowl and my robe, as a bird with its two wings, the traditional simile, I was free to fly whithersoever I wished. Now the idyll was over. I was back at the hermitage and into my role as bhikshu in charge of the Kalimpong branch of the Mahabodhi Society. My wings were again folded, and like Baudelaire's albatross, I had read the French poet a lot during the last few months. I had been obliged to exchange freedom for captivity. According to Baudelaire, the poet was in the same predicament as the albatross. Exiled on the ground, he was unable to walk because of his great wings. The monk, or at any rate the mystic, was also in that predicament, I thought, for at times circumstances forced him too to let his wings drag at his sides, as it were, or at least to fold them. But regardless of whether or not my wings were folded, or whether I even possessed wings at all, I had to walk as best I could. There was a lot to be done now that I was back in Kalimpong. Not only was there mail to be opened, an issue of the Mahabodhi Journal to be put together, and letters to be written, to say nothing of a regular meditation practice to be kept up. There are also visitors to be seen, Sachin to be helped in his studies, the branch's monthly accounts to be made up, and copies of some of my more recent poems to be dispatched to the editor of the Illustrated Weekly of India. Most pressing of all, there were arrangements for the holding of the film shows to be finalised. The film shows, which would, I hoped, place the finances of the Kalimpong branch of the Mahabodhi Society on a more secure footing and lessen the drain on my own resources. At the time of Raj Kapoor's agreeing that we could show two of his films without payment of the usual charges, I was going through a period of financial stringency and the Kalimpong branch with me. Since my return from Calcutta, the stringency had increased, the expenses of Miss Barclay's funeral having swallowed up whatever money I had. And though I could expect to be reimbursed from her estate, this was going to take a long time. In the end, it took a year. And meanwhile, I had to continue subsidising the branch's activities and supporting myself and my few dependents. By the time I left for Assam, the state of my own and the branch's finances was indeed desperate. And 2 weeks later, it was more desperate still. Within days of my being back in Kalimpong, I was confronted by the fact that I had literally no money and no prospect of having any until the arrival of the next instalment of the grant, which, on the recommendation of my teacher, Kashyapji, I was receiving from a wealthy Hindu philanthropist. News that the English Buddhist monk was in financial difficulties was not long in getting around, and even reached Darjeeling. Anikarika Dhammarakshita sent me a cheque for 100 rupees by way of a loan, at the same time taking it upon herself to advise me regarding the kind of life I ought, as a Buddhist monk, to be leading. Those who give help cannot refrain from offering advice, I confided to my diary. Next day I wrote to her returning the cheque, explaining that to accept a loan would only render my position more difficult later on. I also made it clear that I wanted no advice on spiritual matters. Later in the week, when I was still without any money, Sachin turned up one morning with 30 rupees he had borrowed for me from his father. Touched by his thoughtfulness, for I had said nothing to him about my difficulties, I accepted the loan, partly because it was a small one and therefore easily repayable, and partly because it came unaccompanied by any advice. Before my departure for Assam, it had been settled that our film shows would be held in the first week of April. The cruelest month, in India cruelest because hottest, was now almost upon us, and after talking with Dawa, the secretary, I therefore called a committee meeting in order to assign responsibility for such matters as the printing of tickets and the putting up of posters. In the course of discussion, it transpired that we would need to borrow or hire a cine projector. Sachin volunteered the information that a friend of ours in Darjeeling owned one, or at least had access to one. And 2 days later, therefore, only a fortnight after my return from Assam, I found myself once more seated in a Land Rover, and once more dropping down a succession of hairpin bends to Teesta Bridge. And this time, not the plains, but an even longer succession of even more acute hairpin bends up to ever-misty Goom, 8,000 feet above sea level, and thence along the ridge and down a few hundred feet to the Queen of Hill Stations. As we approached the town, I saw on the hillside the pink and white and red of the beautiful flowering trees, at this time of year at their best. The friend to whom Sachin had alluded was Omya, the popular Bengali proprietor of a small watch repair shop on Mackenzie Road. His friend was Tilak Prasad, a Nepalese, who taught at one of the local colleges, and whom I already knew slightly. Both young men were Hindus by birth, English educated, and quite westernised in their outlook. But whereas Omya, who was the elder of the two, was still very much a bachelor, Tilak was already married and the father of a child. Contrary to my expectation, Omya was not in his shop when I called there after breakfast the following morning. Normally he was to be found nowhere else during business hours. But eventually I tracked him down and arranged to meet him and Tilak Prasad at the latter's place that afternoon. Yes, he had access to a cine projector, Tilak was able to assure me a few hours later over a cup of tea. The college had one, and he was confident of being able to borrow it for us. It would take him a little while, however, to arrange matters with the principal. I therefore decided to stay in Darjeeling 3 more days. This would enable me to see a few people, as well as make quite sure that Tulak was, in fact, able to borrow the cine projector for us, and that I would not have to look for one elsewhere. One of the people I wanted to see was Dr. Hudson, who had decided in the end to settle in Darjeeling rather than Kalimpong, at least for the time being, and whom I found comfortably installed in a pleasant bungalow with a cook-bearer and an ayah. She seemed pleased to see me, perhaps because she was in need of someone to talk to. Her servants understood her English, apparently no better than she did her Nepali. At any rate, she talked uninterruptedly for 6 hours, mostly about Buddhism and Theosophy, and I was able to get away only after promising to have tea with her the following day. Tea with her at 4 o'clock the following day I accordingly had, trying not to intervene when miscommunication between the irate mistress with her 2 words of Hindi and the puzzled servants with their broken English became too acute. This time Dr. Hudson held forth on the subject of radiesthesia, about which she seemed to know a good deal, and soon had me performing in this connection various experiments with her crystal pendulum, experiments which I found quite interesting. We also discussed meditation. Before eventually allowing me to depart, she insisted on giving me a viaticum in the form of a homeopathic dose of arsenic, the pendulum having indicated a deficiency of that substance. From crystal pendulum to diamond sceptre, the diamond sceptre of the lamas, as it was sometimes called, was perhaps only a short step, at least from the Jungian point of view. Short step or not, early next morning I was making my way to Alubari Gompa. Alubari, or potato field, was a small settlement too far from Darjeeling to be called a suburb and too near to be called a village, where one might reasonably expect to find the acknowledged symbol of the Vajrayana and even of Tibetan Buddhism itself very much in evidence. On my arrival at the Gompa, which was a temple rather than a monastery, I was welcomed by the head lama and his assistant, as well as by Dorje Bhutia, an English-educated young man of the locality, who, as his surname indicated, was a Darjeeling-born Tibetan. Situated on the quiet hillside, away from any habitations, the unpretentious, whitewashed building was a peaceful place. It was also very well maintained, even though the locality was not, to all appearances, a prosperous one. What was more, the Lakang, or House of Divinities, as the Tibetans called it, besides being richly decorated, was dominated by a giant seated image of Padmasambhava. Though not so big as the one in the Tamang Gompa, in the heart of the bazaar, the sight of which had affected me so profoundly 4 years earlier, it was no less impressive. The light that came through the doorway revealed the same diamond sceptre and skull cup, the one held in his right hand, the other cradled in his left. The same red cloak, the same trident-tipped staff resting in the crook of his arm, the same lotus hat with the vulture feather, the same moustached face, the same wrathful smile. As it happened, I had received that very week a review copy of the Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation, the beautifully illustrated fourth volume in Dr. Y.W. Evans-Wentz's famous Oxford Tibetan series, and in fact had brought it with me to Darjeeling so that I could go on reading it. Among other riches, the volume contained, quote, an epitome of the life and teachings of Tibet's great guru Padmasambhava, end quote, based on excerpts rendered into English by the late Sardar Bahadur Ladan La, Darjeeling's most famous son, assisted by Lama Sonam Senje. Though the mysterious and inspiring figure of Guru Rinpoche, the precious guru, was imprinted so vividly on my consciousness. During the 4 years that had elapsed since my experience in the Tamangompa, I had been able to find out no more about the facts of his life than was already known to me from scholarly histories of Buddhism. With biographical facts in the ordinary sense, however, the Laden La, Evans Wentz's epitome, was little concerned. Its 80-odd pages were replete with marvels and miracles, some of them quite bizarre. As I subsequently observed when reviewing the volume as a whole for the magazine The Aryan Path, quote, "While the present epitome is of very great anthropological interest, one cannot help regretting that it was not possible for the first comprehensive account in English of the great guru's career to have presented him in a more balanced and, we think, in a truer way as a thinker and saint rather than as a cultural hero and thaumaturgist." Though the text translated in the next section, that is, the Yoga of Knowing the Mind, does enable us to gain a more complete picture of his personality. Those who have been fascinated by the spiritual authenticity of the life of Milarepa, an earlier volume in the Oxford Tibetan series, will, we are afraid, be deeply disappointed by the epitome of Padmasambhava's biography. End quote. After all, various books were ascribed to the great guru, and from these, Lama Govinda, at least, had got a vastly different impression of him, an impression, namely, that he was, as my good friend had written recently to me, in words I took the liberty of quoting in my review, quote, "a very sane and profound thinker, a great saint, and a powerful personality, who impressed the people around him so deeply that in their urge to convey his greatness to posterity, they had to take resort to the superhuman and to the miraculous." End quote. I was also critical of Evans Wentz's tendency, in some of his elaborate annotations, to assimilate Buddhist to Hindu teachings, as well as of Carl Gustav Jung's identification in the psychological commentary that constituted the foreword to the volume, of the one mind of the Yoga of Knowing the Mind with the unconscious of modern psychology. Nonetheless, I was grateful for the Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation and read it with avidity. If it failed to enlighten me as to the historical biography of Padmasambhava, it certainly made me better acquainted with his symbolical biography and more vividly aware of Padmasambhava the myth as distinct from Padmasambhava the man. So well had I become acquainted by the time of my visit to the Alubari Gompa with the symbolical biography of the great guru that I was able to explain to the two lamas and Dorje Bhutia the significance of episodes of which they had not even heard. Dorje Bhutia in particular was greatly excited by these explanations, and on my happening to mention the source of my information, insisted on coming to see me that same day in order to inspect for himself the wonderful book in which the secrets of his religion were revealed. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, therefore, as arranged, the young Darjeeling-born Tibetan arrived on my doorstep, and I had the satisfaction of showing him my copy of the Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation and allowing him to go through its pages. I was staying, as nowadays was my custom when visiting Darjeeling, at the Gandhamadan Vihara, the Bengali Buddhist centre on the steep hillside below Chota Kajjora, a rather insalubrious locality on the main road into town. There was still no resident bhikshu, nor any likelihood of there being one. The monks of the Bengali Buddhist Association, of which the Vihara was a branch, not being very keen, by all accounts, on living in a place as cold as Darjeeling could be, and ministering to its tiny Theravadan community. But if there was no resident bhikshu, there was at least a resident nun in the person of Anigarika Dhammalachita, who was occupying not indeed the wooden cutie reserved for members of the monastic order, but one of the row of pukka guest rooms immediately adjacent. On my arrival at Chota Kajora from Kalimpong, she was not at home, but we met that evening after I'd been out and about all day. And though the hour was late and I was tired, she insisted on telling me all about her latest troubles and difficulties. I listened without saying very much, for though not unsympathetic, I knew the aggrieved Anagarika well enough by this time to be aware that she had a tendency to compound her difficulties, such as they were, by her own tactless and aggressive behaviour. This tendency was well illustrated by an unpleasant incident which occurred that very evening. While we were talking, or rather while she was talking and I listening, an elderly Bengali Buddhist who was a permanent occupant of one of the guest rooms came back from work, the worse for drink, and proceeded to cause a disturbance. Out rushed the Anagarika, her face scarlet and quivering with indignation, and upbraided the offender severely, reminding him that the place was a vihara and that he should behave accordingly. The elderly Bengali was not disposed to take this lying down and retaliated with a torrent of coarse abuse. No doubt he should not have been drinking nor have created a disturbance in what was supposedly a monastery, but the Anagarika should have known better than to scold a man while he was under the influence of alcohol, and better, moreover, than to scold him so harshly. The Anagarika was far from seeing matters in this light, and when the following afternoon we visited a leading lay supporter of the Vihara, Dr. Barua, in order to discuss Buddhist activities in the area, she complained bitterly to him and his wife about the way in which the drunken Bengali had spoken to her. As she saw it, she had simply acted to protect the sanctity of the Vihara and been insulted for her pains. If the Bengali Buddhists of Darjeeling had any regard at all for their religion or for those who did observe its precepts, they would not allow one of the guest rooms at their religious centre to be polluted by the presence of a drunkard, but would throw him out immediately. Excessive though the Anagarika's reaction the previous evening may have been, she did, of course, have a point. As I had noticed on my previous visits, two or three of the guest rooms were occupied, permanently as it seemed, by some rather disreputable-looking Bengalis, presumably Buddhists, who took no part in the religious activities of the place, minimal as these were, and who appeared to have turned their corner of the premises into what was virtually a drinking and gambling den. 2 days later, therefore, when Kali Kinka Barua, the secretary of the Vihara, gave me a ceremonial food offering at his house, as he always did at least once whenever I was in Darjeeling, I raised the matter with him. The situation down at Chota Kajora was not very satisfactory, he admitted. But what was he to do? He could hardly ask the occupants of the guest rooms to leave. The rent they paid was the Vihara's only regular source of income. There was no dana worth mentioning. There was no dana because there were no activities. And there were no activities because there was no resident bhikshu. To all this, there was little I could say, especially as I knew that Kali Kumar was a devout Theravadin Buddhist who had the interests of the Vihara very much at heart. Like the Kalimpong branch of the Mahabodhi Society, the Darjeeling branch of the Bengal Buddhist Association suffered from lack of adequate financial support. Kali Kumar had solved the problem by letting some of the guest rooms, albeit the wrong sort of people. I was trying to solve it, at least temporarily, by holding benefit film shows. We were both in the same boat. What with having tea with Dr. Hudson, visiting the Alubari Gompa, and spending time with the Anagarika and my Bengali Buddhist hosts, besides seeing various other people I knew, my additional days in Darjeeling were fully occupied. Omiya and Tilak I met several times after our initial coalescence, and eventually Tilak was able to inform me that he had arranged matters with the principal, and that Omiya would be bringing the cine projector to Kalimpong in good time for our first performance. I was now free to leave Darjeeling, which I did straight after breakfast the following morning. I was not able to bid the Queen of the Hill Stations farewell, however, without having been obliged to hear more about the Anikaraka's troubles and difficulties. Her recital of these had in fact culminated the day before in her telling me that she felt depressed and homesick and shedding a few tears. But deliverance was at hand. Scarcely had she finished wiping her eyes and blowing her nose than there descended on the Vihara, inquiring for her, a French married couple. They were theosophists, it transpired. Like Dr. Hudson, the husband seemed to know a lot about radiesthesia, and he in fact soon offered to give some energy to me, as my vibrations were weak. Radiesthesia seemed to be catching on in the West, I reflected, at least in theosophical circles. The arrival of her two compatriots was a tonic to the Anagarika, and before the visit was over, she had arranged to take them to Goom the following morning, the morning of my departure, and show them the famous Goom Monastery. I was therefore able to leave her in a state of excitement as extreme as that of her previous depression. My own feeling as I left Darjeeling behind me was predominantly one of relief. Now that I had succeeded in borrowing a cine projector, there was no reason why the selling of tickets and other preparations for the film shows should not go ahead. Apart from our having to pick up two police constables and their prisoner, an unkempt Nyingma Lama, the journey passed without incident. I was back at the Hermitage in time for lunch. After lunch, it being a full moon day, I decorated the shrine in readiness for the evening puja and sermon. Not many people attended, but I gave what I thought was a good sermon on who is a Buddhist. Joe was among those present, but after the meeting he became involved, rather inappropriately, I thought, in a long political discussion with a Bengali Hindu friend of mine. Politics was, in fact, difficult to get away from, at least politics in the sense of having dealings with the local administration and the police. Film shows were entertainment. As such, they were liable to entertainment tax. If we were to be exempted from having to pay this on the grounds that our shows were for charity, then we would have to obtain an exemption certificate. I therefore saw both the deputy commissioner, who was in Kalimpong on tour, and the subdivisional officer, or SDO, they apparently being the authorities concerned. I also dispatched Dawa to the Thana, as the police had some undefined role in the business. With both Dutt Manjumdar and the youthful Bengali SDO, I not only talked about the film shows and found out just what was involved in obtaining the exemption certificate, but had a lengthy discussion regarding Christian missionaries and what was to be done about their undesirable methods of conversion, a delicate question I had already raised with Dutt Manjumdar when we met at Longview. In the SDO's case, I also discussed Miss Barclay's affairs and explored the possibility of Vaishakha Purnima, the anniversary of the Buddha's enlightenment, being declared a public holiday throughout the subdivision. With politics, or at any rate its administrative avataras, out of the way, Dawa and I were able to meet the secretary of the town club and finalise the details of our bookings. And as the third week of March was succeeded by the fourth, preparations for the film shows started gathering momentum. Posters went up in the bazaar. Tickets were to be given to members and friends to sell from door to door. Volunteers were briefed on their duties at the town hall on the three nights of the film shows. Finally, to make assurance doubly sure, Dinesh was sent to Siliguri to check whether the precious cylinders had, in fact, been dispatched to us from there by ropeway. While these preparations were in progress, I was also having to carry on with my usual work. There were letters to be written, the Mahabodhi Journal to be edited, and callers to be dealt with, not to mention my having to see to the day-to-day running of the Hermitage. There was also Sachin to be taught. Since my return from Darjeeling, we had embarked on an intensive study of Shelley's shorter poems, such as When Passion's Trance is Overpast and To Jane the Keen Stars Were Twinkling and When the Lamp is Shattered. As tended to happen when we studied poetry together, we were both sometimes left at the end of a session in a mood bordering on the ecstatic. There was also teaching of a more prosaic type to be done. Since my return from Darjeeling, I had acquired two new pupils. One of these was the youngest of Sachin's three younger sisters. The other, Lobsang Phuntsok Lalungpa, the young Tibetan aristocrat, to whom Subdin Tenzin, also known as Marco Pallas, had introduced me 4 years earlier, and who had recently moved with his wife and small son into the Mandula Cottage flat formerly occupied by Miss Barclay. Mira was 12 or 13, and like her brothers and sisters, strikingly good-looking. If Sheila, the eldest sister, could be described as handsome, and Bina, the middle one, as beautiful, Mira could best be described as extremely pretty. Though she seemed to enjoy her lessons with me, she was not very bright, and was much more interested in new saris and the precise arrangement of her kiss curl than in her school books. That I had been asked to teach her, actually to give her practice in English conversation whenever I happened to be at the Singh bungalow, was indicative of the increased closeness of my relations with the whole family. Sachin, having spoken very warmly of the way in which I had looked after him in Calcutta during his illness, I was in fact, for both his parents and his siblings, now more amicus familiae than ever. Lobsang Phuntsok was the son of the Nechung Oracle, the oracle consulted by the Tibetan government, and had been educated in Lhasa as a monk officer. When I first met him, he was still a monk officer. Since then, he had reverted to lay status and married, though whether he continued to be in the service of the Tibetan government was unclear. There was no doubt, however, that he was of a scholarly disposition and highly intelligent. Intelligence beamed from the broad, flat face, which often wore a look of amusement, and twinkled in the small, slit eyes. Mrs. Lobsang, Darjeeling-born and half-Bhutanese, was as beautiful as her husband was handsome. Among the Tibetans, at least, she was reputed to be the most beautiful woman in the district, being even more beautiful than Princess Pema Tsedjian, the eldest daughter of the Maharaja of Sikkim, now past her prime. Unfortunately, she had the habit of screwing up her eyes every few minutes, which rather detracted from the impression she made. Despite being such a belle, she was of a friendly, obliging disposition, and though I had met her only once or twice, I had no hesitation in giving her two or three books of tickets and asking her to sell them. As it happened, she sold more tickets for us than anyone else did, selling them mostly to Tibetan government officers, who, I suspected, bought them more because they wanted to please her than because they wanted to support the work of the Kalimpong branch of the Mahabodhi Society. The week of the film shows was now, in fact, upon us. The cylinder containing the films had been collected from the ropeway station. Ermia had brought the cine projector from Darjeeling, and on the morning of the 3rd of April, immediately after breakfast, with Dawa and three or four volunteers, I conveyed the equipment by jeep to the town hall, where we spent the rest of the morning making the shabby, run-down old place as presentable as we could. With so much depending on the reliability of the projector, I took the precaution of getting Mr. King, a nationalist Chinese who had worked as an electrician in Lhasa, to come and check that it was functioning properly. He having assured me that it was functioning perfectly and that I had nothing to worry about, I went home to lunch, returning to our temporary cinema an hour later. There was still much to be done, and the volunteers and I were kept busy right up to the time the doors opened. Despite all our efforts, however, the performance was a flop. Only 7 tickets were sold, which meant that, even allowing for the fact that a number of people had bought tickets in advance but had not bothered to come, our first film show was a decided failure. Drastic action would have to be taken. Next morning I gave Mrs. Lobsang more tickets to sell, and myself spent the remainder of the morning and most of the afternoon selling tickets from house to house and shop to shop in the bazaar. The result was that our second show was a success. The first performance, there were 2 performances this time, was very well attended, possibly because it was Sunday, though attendance at the second was less good. There being 2 performances, the show ended very late, and I did not get to bed until 2 a.m. Most of the people attending the shows were Tibetans of both sexes and all ages, and including a generous sprinkling of shaven heads and red robes. As I already knew, Tibetans were great cinema goers, and few were the sturdy exiles from the Land of Snows who did not see every film that was screened at the town's then one and only Bioscope. As I also knew, the Tibetans were particularly fond of violent films. Thus, it was not surprising that their favourite genre should have been the Western, in which there was a clearly defined conflict, in which plenty of blows and shots were exchanged, and which ended with dead bodies lying on the ground. If they had had the patience to wait for the last act, the Tibetans would probably have enjoyed Hamlet. Which genre, or genres, the 2 Raj Kapoor films represented, I did not know, as I refrained from actually seeing them. They were certainly not Westerns, and in all probability contained little or no fighting. Some of the Tibetan members of the audience may therefore have been disappointed. One of them undoubtedly was, though whether because of the lack of violence or for some other reason was unclear. As I stood beside the door waiting for the end of the performance, a burly figure strode out in disgust, loudly declaring that it was the worst film he had ever seen. Despite this unfavourable verdict on the part of at least one of our patrons, I did not allow myself to be discouraged, but did whatever I could to ensure the success of our third and last film show. As this did not take place until Wednesday, I had 2 clear days in which to boost the sale of tickets. On the Wednesday afternoon, however, when 2 volunteers had spent the morning giving the show extra publicity in the bazaar, Mr. King discovered that the projector's exciter bulb had fused. Having failed to obtain a replacement either in the bazaar or at the Chinese school, I therefore decided, as a last resort, to try Dr. Graham's Homes. The Homes was, of course, a Christian missionary institution, and I had already tried, with no very great success, to sell tickets there, on the principle that if Christians could ask Buddhists and Hindus to support their work, as they frequently did, then there was no reason why Buddhists and Hindus should not ask Christians to support theirs. Mr. Duncan, the way-faced, tight-lipped superintendent of the Homes, obviously did not believe in such mutuality, and frostily told me, "We do not approve of your activities." Though eventually he did agree, with the greatest reluctance, to accept a few tickets and even to put up a notice about them. Rubicund Mr. Muir, the headmaster of the Holmes School, and his deputy, Mr. Ross, were more cooperative. They did not have a spare exciter bulb, but they did have a projector, and this they agreed to lend us. Back with it, I therefore sped to the Hermitage, where the volunteers were waiting to take our equipment to the town hall, and where I quickly finalised arrangements for the evening's show. As if the fuser of the exciter bulb was not trouble enough, I also had to deal that afternoon with the problem of the anagarika. The volatile Frenchwoman had arrived with her 2 French friends soon after my own return from Darjeeling. The friends had stayed for 2 days, putting up at the Himalayan Hotel, and she had shown them the sights of Kalimpong and taken them to see Joe and Dr. Rowich. On their departure for Calcutta, after I had conducted a special puja for them in the shrine, she was again thrown on her own resources, which meant that she took to spending more time at the hermitage than was either convenient or desirable. She also took to handing me a written confession after the evening puja, sometimes staying on to explain or discuss it. As I was planning to leave for Calcutta in the middle of the month in order to see the Vaishakha number of the Mahabodhi Journal through the press, and did not want her moving into the hermitage during my absence, as she had done before, I took the precaution of making arrangements for her to stay at Tirupai. When I tried to speak to her about these arrangements, however, after the volunteers had left for the town hall with our equipment, she burst into tears and wept bitterly for half an hour. I was therefore obliged to spend another half hour and more reminding her that the monastic life had its difficulties and that she could not always have what she wanted, with the result that I was later leaving the hermitage than I had intended. On arriving at the town hall, I found the place nearly full and people still turning up. But if fortune, that fickle goddess, had decided to favour us that evening, she soon changed her mind. Despite our combined efforts, we could not get the home's projector working, and at the end of 3 hours were forced to admit defeat. By this time the audience had become restive, even vociferous, and having made what excuses we could, we had to send people home with the promise that there would be a free show the following evening. When they had gone, we again tested the projector, and eventually at about 11 o'clock managed to get it working. That night I did not sleep until the early hours. Very trying day, with innumerable disappointments and luck apparently dead against us, I noted in my diary, adding, "But we must carry on." In the immediate context, carrying on meant putting on a film show that very evening, the evening of Thursday as it now was, and putting on a film show meant finding a new exciter bulb, for it was obvious that we could not rely on the home's projector and would have to fall back on Tilax. No exciter bulb being obtainable in Kalimpong, finding a new one meant taking a trip to Darjeeling. In the morning, I therefore caught the 9 o'clock Land Rover, reaching my destination in a record time of less than 2 hours. After scouring all the radio and electrical shops in the town without success, meeting many friends on the way, I eventually located the bulb I wanted with a friend of Tilak's. As I too was a friend of Tilak's, and as this naturally made me his friend and he mine, he was happy to let me borrow it, and I was back in Kalimpong, the elusive exciter bulb safe in my shoulder bag, a couple of hours before the film show was due to begin. This time fortune smiled on us the whole evening. The town hall was full, the projector gave no trouble, the audience seemed to be satisfied. As I walked up and down outside in the dark, waiting for the performance to finish, I felt relieved that we had been able to keep our promise, relieved that the film shows had proved not wholly unsuccessful, and relieved, I had to admit, that the last performance would soon be over, and that I would soon be seeing the last of our present audience, at least in their cinema-going capacity. But had it really been worth it? Had all the trouble and worry been justified? In any case, I was a monk. I was trying to lead a spiritual life. Yet here I was, organising film shows, selling tickets in the bazaar, and running from place to place in search of exciter bulbs. Why was I doing this? True, the work of the Kalimpong branch of the Mahabodhi Society had to be carried on, and its finances therefore placed on a secure footing. But was this really a sufficient reason for my becoming so deeply involved in what were, undeniably, worldly activities? And what was the significance of such involvement for my own spiritual life? Was I being, or trying to be, a good bodhisattva engaging in worldly activities for the benefit, ultimately, of other people? Or was I simply being a bad monk, allowing myself to be distracted from my true vocation of self-purification? Whichever it may have been, and the two were not necessarily antithetical, the end of the film shows did not mean the end of the work connected with them. Films and projectors had to be returned, chairs in the town hall restored to their former positions, money collected from Mrs. Lobsang and others, and full details of ticket sales submitted to the DC, the STO and the police in connection with our application for exemption from entertainment tax. There are also the accounts of the film shows to be made up and the extent to which the Mahabodhi Society's Kalimpong branch had benefited from them ascertained. Unfortunately, it had not benefited as much as I had hoped it would, certainly not enough to place its finances on a secure footing even for a short period. This did not altogether surprise me. The sluggishness of ticket sales prior to the shows and the piling up of unlooked-for expenses had forewarned me that such would probably be the case, and I had taken action accordingly. The action had been drastic. I had sold the only objects of any monetary worth I possessed, my tankers. These tankers, a set of three depicting the 16 Arahants travelling by sea to China on the backs of various monsters, had been a farewell present from Marco Palace, and hence possessed a sentimental as well as a religious value for me, so that I was extremely loath to part with them. But part with them I did, in the circumstances I had no choice. Fortunately, I did not have to do the actual selling myself. Joe happening to mention that he thought he could sell them for me, I handed them over to him, and a few days later he brought me 600 rupees. Neither then nor afterwards did he tell me to whom he had sold the tankers, only assuring me that he had sold them, as I had stipulated, to someone who would treat them with proper respect. However, I knew that Prince Peter, for whom Joe had recently started working, currently had the Italian ambassador staying with him, and drew my own conclusions. 600 rupees were not a great sum, but together with what we had made from the film shows, it would cover the branch's expenditure for the next few months. I could therefore prepare for my journey to Calcutta with a light heart, without having to worry about the immediate future of our work. Whether because the strain of organising the film shows was now over, or for some other reason, during the week that preceded my departure, light-heartedness was indeed the dominant mood among the Hermitage's little band of youthful habitués. Certainly it was the mood when Sachin and Dawa and I, together with half a dozen others, spent the day picnicking at Durpin, at the southeastern end of the ridge on which Kalimpong was situated. Rain had recently fallen, and the haze being finer than usual, we could see 4,000 feet below, and bathed in the golden sunlight, a vast expanse of level countryside, stretching away into the distance for 40 or 50 miles, as it seemed, before finally merging with the overarching blue of the sky. This picnic was not my only outing that week. One afternoon I had tea at Turpai with Geshe Wangyal, a Mongolian monk who was a friend of Marco Palace's and had been his guest in England in the 30s. The Geshe, or Doctor of Buddhist Divinity, as some translated the title, was planning to leave Kalimpong. In fact, he was planning not only to leave Kalimpong, but to emigrate to America and teach Tibetan there in an institute of higher learning. I had no such plans. I was happy in Kalimpong, and whatever the difficulties, I would stay there and work for the good of Buddhism, as my teacher had directed.
End of chapter 7.